Before we get started, I'm really so happy to be able to facilitate this meeting on advocacy, this session on advocacy. I've been blind all my life, and so for me, being a self-advocate has been part and parcel of who I am ever since I was a small child. Deborah and Maria interviewed me for Voices of Vision about a week or so ago. And, you know, they asked me, well, why did you want to do this particular session? Well, for me, it is just so essential that we, as people with blindness and low vision, speak for ourselves, tell our stories, speak our truth. And we do that, but we could be more effective in doing that. And so, you know, I met with our two delegates, and I'll just share that, you know, I shared with them, basically, we do advocacy on the federal level with the leadership, with the American Council of the Blind. We support the initiatives that are being brought forward to us, and we meet with the legislative staff every spring. We do that, and I think we do pretty well. We probably should follow up more with folks on the different bills as they progress through Congress. Many of us also advocate on the local level, you know, where we serve on boards and committees, and we're very active in our local communities on issues that are of concern to us. But we don't do as well in Richmond. We don't do as well advocating at the state level. And it's a place where we can have an impact. So if there's one thing I want you to get out of this session is how we can have more impact at the state level. So let me introduce these two gentlemen. We have two delegates, Patrick Hope from District 1 and Rodney Willett from District 58. District 1 is in Arlington. District 58 is in Richmond. And I met with these two wonderful people about a week ago to, you know, discuss the session, what our goals were. And I've got to tell you, these are great guys. These are our allies. And we can have many more allies in Richmond if we reach out and contact people and get to know them. But we have to do so in an effective way. So what Patrick and Rodney are going to talk to you about today is, you know, how is the process in Richmond different from what it is in Washington? How we can be more successful? They're going to tell us a few stories about things that worked and also things that didn't work so that we can be more educated. And we're going to take what they tell us today, and we are going to work together in developing initiatives that we can share with our delegates and senators in January in Richmond. So, without any further ado, I'm not sure which one of you is first. who is speaking first? Patrick? Okay. Patrick Hope, again, from District 1 in Arlington. Yes. Very good.
I'll just stand here.
Okay.
Well, actually, there's a podium here, so I'll be here at the podium, if that's okay. No, that's okay. Well, good morning, everyone. It's good to meet everyone. I'm so pleased to be here today. I'm Delegate Patrick Hope. I represent the 1st District of the Virginia, which is in Arlington County. This is my, just completing my 16th year in office. I serve on the Courts of Justice Committee, which I chair the Courts of Justice Committee. And just for those of you that don't know, in Virginia, we elect our entire judicial branch of government. And from the district court level to the appellate court, all the way to the highest court in Virginia. And the committee is the central point for nominating all judges to the bench. So it's an entire branch of government that the General Assembly has the responsibility to elect. And so that's really important. I'm also on the Health and Human Resources Committee, which I serve with my colleague that you'll hear from in a bit, Delegate Willett. And I'm also on the Public Safety Committee as well. I want to talk to you a little bit about advocacy, and I'm so excited that you're engaging at the state level. And I tell you this from the experience that I've been a federal lobbyist in the past. I've worked on Capitol Hill for a number of years, and I can just tell you, and you probably already know this, it's very difficult and very challenging to get anything accomplished at the federal level. And I'm not saying anything that's a news flash to you, but at the state level, there's certainly more access to the members of your delegation, and it's a much faster process to get things going. So I always encourage people to advocate at the state level. It's really easy to lose sight of that, and just because the news is constantly talking about what's happening at the federal level. But really, the states are where things are actually getting done. And so I'm glad that you're taking this initiative to do that. I've always felt advocacy is a contact sport, but it's also a team sport. What do I mean by that? It's a contact sport because you have to advocate for yourselves. Nobody's going to do it for you. And it's basic stuff that you've learned, that you have a communication, have a conversation with your delegate or your senator, who is what we call them, that we call the people that Rod and I at the House level, we're delegates, not House of Representatives. But have a conversation with them, meet them at home, call them, set up a Zoom call with them. We're very accessible to do that. It's also a team sport because, and this is what really what you're doing here, is you're advocating as a group. And so it's not just one person coming in asking for something. It is collectively people talking about these problems. And it's always really helpful for us to listen to what the concern is, but to come with a solution. And that's really what it's all about for us, is describe what the problem is and what the solution might be. And the other thing I would emphasize to you is that you really have a level of expertise that I can't get from a lobbyist. And don't think of yourself as a lobbyist. You're really an educator is what you really are. And in most cases, you're the constituent. So technically, you're their boss. And you can ask them for things and expect them to give you some sort of response. So develop that relationship. You have that expertise to come in there and say, hey, look, this is a problem that I'm experiencing in my life, and here's a solution that will make it better. And I think having that kind of relationship one-on-one, it was mentioned earlier about following up, really important to follow up. Establish a relationship with your delegate or your senator. Don't consider it just to be a one-off where you go and meet with them once and that's it. Continue to follow up. It's your right to do that and find out where they are on that particular issue. So go in, you identify the problem. You know, I think, and I've mentioned this already, how the differences between the federal and state are, you can really get things more done at the state level, but you can get an answer right away at the state level. For example, if you introduce a bill in Congress, it may sit there for years before it's ever acted upon. At the state level, if you introduce a bill, it will have a hearing. It's almost virtually guaranteed that that bill will have a hearing, and you will get an opportunity to testify about it. But that's not the way it works in Congress. And so that's a big difference right there. And the process is very simple. I mean, if you come in with an issue that is identified as a problem, well, the solution could be a multiple different ways. And so you should be able to brainstorm. And I know Delegate Willett and I would make ourselves available to have these conversations with you collectively to talk about ways that we can solve your problem. The answer could be a bill. It could be a change in the code that needs to be corrected. It could be we need to do a study. We need to take a look at this. Our sessions are very short. We have, our long session is only 60 days. It's not very long. It's just 2 months. And our shorter session is which they alternate years, is just 45, 46 days. So it's a very short timeline. But that doesn't mean we stop working for you. we're working for you year round. But if some of these ideas that you might have might be a little bit more complicated, they might involve some stakeholders. Sometimes you have opposition. And so it's, you got to get everyone together in the same room. It's almost like marriage counseling sessions sometimes, and try to get people to understand exactly what you're trying to do. And then sometimes the solution means mitigating those solutions, addressing what those solutions might be. So a way to make progress on your initiative is to have a study. And so that may be part of the solution, is to bring a work group together to help solve that problem. It could be, your answer could be a bill that becomes an appropriation. And I know Delegate Willett's going to talk, because he serves on the Appropriations Committee, can talk a little bit about that process in terms of, if it's a funding issue, then that's the solution, and that's a different process. And then maybe it's just an agency or an administrative thing where you're asking for a different department. Like, we work a lot with DARS. Maybe it's working with a different agency to get them to interpret something a little bit differently, or write a regulation or a rule or something like that. So maybe that's the solution. But working with your delegate or your senator can help you figure out what the answer is. And so let's say, for example, that your solution is, we need a bill, we need a law in to solve the problem that we have. Well, then if we introduce a bill for you, that's going to get a hearing, as I said. And the opportunity for you to engage in that process is not the end or the beginning, where I probably should say it is the beginning, to engage in that process, because you have an opportunity to come and testify. And I'll tell you, just the process is, it's a very informal setting. We all get together, and they'll call up a bill that Delegate Willett will introduce. He will describe the bill, and then they will take testimony from the audience, either online or in person, to find out who is supporting of the bill and why, and who is opposed to the bill and why. And then the subcommittee or the committee will vote on the bill. Now, there's a lot of things that you need to do leading up to that. It doesn't just sort of, you snap your fingers and suddenly you have a bill. You have to meet. This is the perfect time to start meeting with your delegates and your senators. By a show of hands, does everyone know who their delegate and their senator are? Just raise your hand and I can describe. It's less than half of people raise their hands who know who they are. So that, we got to fix that. We got to fix that. You need to look up who your delegate and who your senator is after this conference, if not during this conference. And then you need to think about reaching out to their office and setting up an appointment. You don't have to have anything to say other than, I just want to introduce myself to you. If you ever have legislation having to do with blind community or vision impaired community, please let me know, and I would love to talk to you more. You might have an issue. There might be some issues that come out of this meeting where you can sort of plant that seed, but you should absolutely meet with them. Say that you represent the organization you represent, and say that you want to talk to them separately, and bring in some of your leaders to come into some of those meetings as well. But make sure that you establish that contact. And I think that there's been an effort to try to get an advocacy day in Richmond sometime in January, I think. Take advantage of that. Take a bus. Everyone come up and take the effort, take a half a day to come and meet with your delegate or your senator to talk about the issues that you all as a team collectively have identified as an issue. So participate in Lobby Day. Meet with your lawmakers. Again, this is the contact part I was talking about. This is a contact sport. You have to meet with them. Send them emails. Follow up. You can make it stay local. You know, I have a great little donut shop in Arlington called Good Company. The best donuts I've ever eaten in my life. We got an applause there. Good Company is fantastic. I love to meet people out there for coffee and a donut. I tell you, we have such a great conversation to do that. But of course, I also meet by Zoom. One of the good outcomes if you can describe, if you can find a silver lining for COVID, was that we are meeting much more virtually. We're flexing that muscle, and that gives more access to the public who ordinarily doesn't, isn't able to get to a lot of our meetings in Richmond. So Zoom and Teams has been a lifesaver for a lot of people to have that contact. And it makes life easier for us too. Frankly, it's not an imposition for Delegate Willett and I and our colleagues to meet with you, because that's part of our job. We want to hear what's on your mind. And again, no one's going to advocate for you unless you advocate for yourself. I want to give a couple examples, guys. I know I'm probably talking a lot. A couple of examples of what works and what doesn't work. A couple of years ago, I brought a bill about electronic prescribing. And this would allow people that are vision impaired to make sure that there's some arrangement that they have with the pharmacist, so that, because if you look at all your different pill bottles, it's really hard to tell which one is which. The pills might look the same. Certainly the vials of the bottles are, look identical. And of course, if you're vision impaired, you can't see the name of the drug. And so making sure that allows these have these readers that you can have downloaded on your phone to be able to scan the bottle so that you know exactly what you're taking and you're not taking the wrong thing. They've done this in other states, so we know it can be done. And so it's just bringing everyone together. Well, we were successful. I brought the bill. We had a lot of advocates come up. They came up on the, had a lobby day. They met with their delegates and their senators. We had the bill was, had a hearing. People came to testify that talked about, people actually brought vials of the two or their bottle, pill bottles. And it was like, yeah, I can't tell that from another. And everyone had, I mean, I'll tell you my personal, I take cholesterol lowering drugs and also high blood pressure. And the vials look exactly the same to me. And so I even messed it up making sure that I got the right bottle right at the right time. And so that was really eye-opening for a lot of the members on the committee, and demonstrating how easy it is to pull out your phone and to scan it over the bottle so that you know it, so it tells you, it speaks and tells you exactly what that means. So long story short, that bill passed the House, it went over to the Senate, it passed the Senate, and the governor signed it into law. Now, there's a lot of complications on the way, because you can imagine the pharmacists weren't really happy with that idea, because they were concerned that they'd have to do more work, or they'd have to invest in some new technology that they'd never heard of before, which we know they had. And so we had those conversations, and we worked our way through, and we kind of just muscled it all the way through to the governor's desk. The governor heard from your community and said, there's no real reason not to sign this into law. And so we did, and so it became the law. So that's a good, that but that's the contact sport, that's the team sport. I didn't do it, you all did it, advocating together and meeting with your delegates and your senators and being present for that testimony. Now let me tell you another example that I introduced a couple of years ago that was not successful. You know, it's voting. It's always voting time, and so hopefully people are getting ready to vote if you haven't already. But I know it's especially difficult for this community to vote in, you want to vote in private. That should be your right to be able to vote private. You shouldn't have to rely on someone else to help vote for you to mark the right box. And so we've been doing electronic voting for years. Just not for you. We've been doing it for military and overseas. People can safely vote electronically. And so what I'm trying to do is expand the definition for who's eligible to vision impaired community, to be allowed people with disabilities that be allowed to vote online. And so it's in the comfort of your own home, the privacy of your own home, so that you can vote the way you want to vote, not with someone standing over your shoulder. And so, and that's what we're trying to do. So I brought the bill, and the opposition said, this is very unsafe. You can't, this could be hacked into, our system could be hacked into if we allow this. But I said, but what about the military? What about people that are overseas working for State Department? They're allowed to do it, but we don't extend this right to anyone else like they've done in many other states. So long story short, I brought the bill, and they asked, who's here to speak in favor of the bill? No one came. No one came. And then they said, who's here to speak in opposition to the bill? Well, a bunch of groups came. And we're throwing all these really crazy red herrings up, saying that this would be unsafe, we'd be hacked into. I'm like, you know, of all the things that President Trump talked about, having the 2020 election to be so-called rigged, he never brought this up. He never said the military or the retirees or people that are overseas, but he never said that was hacked into, but he always blamed other things. So the risks are very low of doing this. And so we're going to bring that bill back, but I need cover. I need you to support this effort. I need you to meet with your lawmakers. I need you to show up. Remember, contact sport, team sport. I need you to all show up and talk about why this is important that we're allowed you to do it. And it's your right. It should be your right to be able to take a private vote. Yes. So that's why I need you. And so that's an example. We know example of what works and what doesn't work. And so I'm going to go ahead and stop there. I think what we can do is if we want, we can have Delegate Willett speak, and then afterwards we can have a Q&A between the two of us. Is that okay?
Yes.
All right. So you want to introduce my colleague, Delegate Willett from Richmond. He's on the very powerful Appropriations Committee. He's also on the Healthcare Committee. I'm so lucky to call him a friend and colleague, and it's an honor to serve with him. So I'll hand it over to you, Delegate Willett.
Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you, Patrick. You're hearing from a veteran there. I've only been doing this 6 years. Patrick's got a few more years than I do in the House. No, it is absolutely wonderful to be with you here this morning. As I was introduced, I'm Delegate Rod D. Willett. I'm from the 58th House District, so that's parts of Western Henrico, just south of here in Richmond. Patrick and I were saying this is a great meeting location because it's about in the middle between the two districts that we have. So no, we really appreciate that. No, I think I'm going to piggyback on a couple things Patrick said, and he really gave you, an excellent outline of how to be effective in your advocacy in terms of communicating with us. And the good news is, just to summarize, is you can communicate with us and you can be effective. We actually do get bills passed in Richmond. No offense to my friends up 95 a little bit, but you don't see a lot of things passing in Congress right now. We pass hundreds and hundreds of bills in Richmond. So there is that absolute opportunity. I was going to share some personal stories and anecdotes, and first of all, just to connect with you, my mother-in-law lived with my family for a number of years and was legally blind, and that was quite an experience for a whole family. But what I learned through that is just what an amazing life someone can live, even though they're visually impaired, or in this case, actually blind. My mother-in-law, in a lot of cases, people didn't even know she had that impairment. Just because of the life she led with our family and the things she was very active and the things she was able to do. I don't know how many folks use Virginia Voice. Virginia Voice use here? Yeah. I'm a big fan of Virginia Voice. She loved that service. And oh my gosh, she'd have that radio on. She used the radio program. She had it on all day long. And I was actually jealous in some ways because she was getting news that I was not getting. It was pretty funny. And I think they've done some amazing things now. I was just at a fundraiser for them. They now are doing, I guess they call it live events. They actually, there's a parade. Yeah, okay, it's really cool. So there actually literally is a broadcaster telling us what's going on at a parade or other event. I thought that was just amazing. So anyway, through her, I learned quite a bit just in how you can still lead your life, lead a very, very productive life. She had my kids to help take care of there. They grew up with her being part of our family and our household. And then I have a sister-in-law and brother-in-law with a bunch of kids up in Winchester, not terribly far from here. And likewise, she lived with them for a period of time and was able to similarly interact with them and enjoy their lives together. So it's been an amazing experience. I thought I would sort of hone in on a couple of things Patrick had said with a little more color just from my experience. And so much of the effectiveness of advocacy really is sharing your story. really sharing your lived experience, because we are not you, but we want to hear from you. And just as Patrick said, we absolutely will entertain meetings with you. As we've said a couple of times, know your legislators, reach out to them. They will meet with you. That can be in person, it can be via Zoom, it could be in one-on-one, it could be a group of folks coming in there. You can certainly do that during the legislative session, which is coming up, and you know, lobby days are great when you show up in force and come and talk to us. But the off season is great too. I'm having this week, for example, in Richmond, I probably had a half dozen meetings with constituents who had a number of different issues to raise with me, but they're meeting, you know, more one-on-one with me or with my staff to talk about issues. Some of that's in person, again, some of that's in Zoom. But folks will take that meeting. That's one of our jobs, is to talk to our constituents. So make those connections and reach out to people. You can put a finer point on that. And yes, if your bill, like Patrick mentioned, a couple of bills there, those are going to go to specific committees. So in some cases, you need to target the members of those committees. And it's the whole committee. I mean, yes, it's important to meet the chair and the vice chair, but everybody has a vote on the committee or the subcommittee. So you really should meet Republicans, Democrats, the highest ranking member to the newest member. Meet with them all to talk about it, because everybody on that committee has a voice and has a vote and wants to hear your voice. I was going to mention, going back to the effectiveness, just a couple of stories that were really compelling stories that ultimately led to the passage of legislation. And sometimes it's an unfortunate story that leads to a much more fortunate result. And probably one of the best examples that actually happened in my county, in my district, there was a beautiful young woman, an eighth grade middle school student named Lucia Bremer. And she and a good friend were home from school on a beautiful day, kind of like today, and left their home, were walking behind a high school. Another young student, young man at his home who had a lot of serious behavioral health issues, unfortunately got a hold of a loaded weapon, a firearm, in the family's home. He really had no idea what he was doing, but he used that weapon to actually shoot Lucia as well as her friend. Her friend survived, Lucia did not. An absolute tragedy. The legislators from that area were devastated by that loss. Lucia's family was very well known. She was an extremely popular student. Soccer player, did community activities. I mean, she was only 13 years old, but she still did so much in the community. And several of us, including my colleague, Skyler Van Balkenburg, he's now in the state Senate, knew we need to do something legislatively. There were a couple of gaps in the law in terms of parental responsibility, because really what we saw here, I mean, we can't blame the kid. The kid didn't know what he was doing. His parents, though, should have known that you could not leave a weapon within reach of someone who really had no business, as a 13-year-old especially, having access to that weapon. And so we put legislation forward. And I'll just tell you, in the current environment, getting gun safety bills passed is a tough thing. And so we knew we had an uphill battle. Not so much that we had there was a majority of interest in passing it in the House and the Senate, but we still had to get the governor to sign it. But this is what we did. And this really was just an amazing effort to think about being the parents of Lucia and to have me and have Skyler and Balkenberg ask them, could they share her story? Really tough, but they did. And it took a while. This actually was a 2-year effort. And it was really the second year where they actually reached out to us and said, we're ready to tell our story. We're ready to get this bill passed. Because what they saw was that this incident, unfortunately, was not the only one. That there were other incidents where people were not taking care of the weapons, not taking care of their families. And so they came forward when we presented the bills. I can tell you, I spoke for about 30 seconds and then turned the podium over to Lucia's parents. They told that this horrendous story of what had happened to their daughter. And yes, there were tears shed in that room that day by the committee members. And I'm not saying you have to bring many members to tears to get a bill passed, but it was an incredible story, an incredibly moving story. And that bill passed almost unanimously there. And this is with Republicans and Democrats voting. By the time it got to the House and Senate floors, respectively, almost unanimous support. And this is for a gun safety bill, a gun safety bill. The governor that year, so this is that was the easy part, actually. And then comes the hard part, as Patrick said, you still have to have the governor sign the bill. And at that point, and I'll give you the numbers, 2 years ago, the governor vetoed over 34 gun safety bills. So you can do the math. Odds were not looking good for us. But the story, the passion from Lucia's parents was so strong, it was almost a dare for him not to sign the bill, and he did. He did ultimately sign the bill, and it passed, and we now have what's called Lucia's Law in the Commonwealth of Virginia. Thank you. And again, that's an incredible story, and I'm not saying you have to have the most incredible story, but it moved people. It really moved people, and even folks who not in a million years thought they were going to be voting for a gun safety measure voted for that bill because they knew we had to do something. There was a loophole in the law. We had to address that. And I think we made progress. On a lighter note, I'm going to tell you another story just to make this the point that how compelling stories are. I got a letter from, of all people, an 8-year-old constituent. His name is Liam. And Liam is he's fourth grade now. He's in third grade then. Liam one day had gone to his mom and said, "Mom, I am really concerned about trees." And his mom said, "What do you mean, Liam?" He said, "Yeah, we're cutting down all the trees, and without enough trees, the planet's warming up. It's global warming. It's climate change." And so Liam's mom said, "Well, Liam, what you should do is write a letter to your representative." He said, "What do you mean by representative?" He said, "Well, we have people in government who actually take care of us. They pass laws and bills to help address issues. You should write to them." And so Liam said, "Oh, you mean like Congress?" And she said, "Well, you could write to Congress. They're not getting a lot done these days." So, she suggested, "But you know, we have state government too, and they actually are getting things done." So, she looked up the representatives. I'm the representative for that part of Henrico County. So I got from Liam, I got a handwritten letter. Little hard to read. His mom attached sort of a translation for it. He's still working on the handwriting, but what I could read, most importantly, was I could see the picture he'd drawn of several trees. And Liam said, "I really want you to carry a bill to protect our trees." So that was wonderful. I wrote a letter on my official stationery, sent a letter back to him. I said, "Liam, I really, really appreciate your interest in here. I share your passion around protecting trees. We'll see what we can do." Well, I believe in the power of coincidence. That same year, the Chesapeake Bay Foundation approached me about carrying a bill to protect tree canopy. Oh. And so I jumped right on that, and I called up Liam's mom, said to Liam and his mother, said, "I think we've got a bill to work on here." So we worked on the bill with the Bay Foundation, got that drafted up. And this is the same process you would go through in working a bill. You work with your legislator, you would work with the drafting services to get that text. You then have to go to the subcommittee that the bill is assigned to. So I had the unfortunate news of telling Liam's parents that subcommittee meets at 7 a.m. on a school day. But Liam made it. He put on his little blue blazer, came down to the General Assembly, had to wait an hour and a half to testify. That's a long time for me. It's a long time for an 8-year-old. But his time came. So I've said just a few words. Liam came up to the podium kind of like this, got his letter out, and he read his letter. And Patrick knows Kathy Tran, who was a really good friend of ours. She's a delegate from just north of here in Fairfax. So Kathy was the chair. She's also the mother of a whole bunch of kids, so very sympathetic chairwoman. But Liam presented his bill. We then had, and this is again something you would need to do. You may present your point, but then you need your friends. And this back to what Patrick said in terms of this being a team sport. We had lined up a number of groups, most of the environmental support groups, to talk on behalf of this bill and to show their support. And a lot of times all they say is, "We support the bill." But that's significant because the committee members are watching the people in the room to see who's supporting it. What was interesting is that people started referring to the bill, even though it hadn't become a law yet, they started calling it Liam's Law. And so someone would come up and say, I support Liam's Law. I support Liam's Law. This is the best part, though. The Home Builders Association, not known for being the best tree protectors in Virginia, was represented in the room. This was not their favorite bill, but they didn't necessarily strongly oppose it. They probably just weren't going to say much about it. But the other groups, this is like 20 people at this point have said, I support Liam's Law. They looked over to the representative and said, you really need to say something about the bill. So they basically publicly shamed the lobbyists for the home builders to come up and say, I support Liam's Law. That was it. At that point, we knew we were good. So we got through the subcommittee, the full committee, very strong vote. Got through the House with a really strong vote. And then I told Liam, you know, that's the House part. Now you have to do the same thing again in the Senate. It's like, really? Same thing again? So yes, you've got to pass the bill. And the same when a bill starts in the Senate. So again, for your bills, that's the process to go through. So Liam got up again. I think this was only 7:30 in the morning, but I had to come down in his little blue blazer and testify again. But a similar result. People loved his story. He got almost unanimous support for it. So we got Liam's Law through the Senate committee process and then the Senate floor vote, almost unanimous, to pass Liam's Law. So Liam is a very excited 8-year-old at this point. And then I had to call him. I said, Liam, your bill passed the House. That's amazing. Your bill passed the Senate, that's amazing. But bills in Virginia do not become laws until the governor signs them. And I said, you know, unfortunately, the governor is not signing a lot of environmental protection laws these days. So we'll see what happens. The bill's gonna go to him, but ultimately, it's the governor's decision. So we waited, and I think just to explain the process, the governor has a period of time to review the bills and then decide whether to sign them or to veto them. And I, you know, fingers crossed, like, oh, this is going to be tough, because he was not signing a lot of tree-related protection bills. But I got a little update from my staff. He signed the bill. He signed the bill. So I said, I've got to talk to Liam. So I had Liam's mother's cell phone number. I waited, because this was during the school year. And I think it was 3:30 he gets home, so I called about 4 o'clock. Called Liam's mama, says, Liam there, and she says, well, as a matter of fact, she didn't know I was calling, said, he's right here. So she puts him on speakerphone, and I go, Liam, the governor signed your bill. He literally starts screaming. I could hear him jumping up and down. He was the most excited constituent I've ever had in my life. If I can make every constituent that happy, what could I do? But anyway, no, it was an absolute amazing experience, and Liam got his bill passed, and we have Liam's Law now protecting trees. So there's some long stories, but it's just to show you the power of your experience, the power of sharing a story like that, and then how compelling that can be to us as legislators. Because, yes, and numbers are important. You're going to have amazing statistics to share as well, and that's important. The numbers, the facts, the figures, how many people like you are affected by a bill, the bills Patrick's talking about, how many people actually could take advantage of the prescription drug, the reader being able to have the prescriptions read, or the voting access. So the numbers matter. The stories, though, are really compelling. So I absolutely encourage you to come share your stories. The one other thing I was going to share with you is we talk a lot about the bills and the laws that are passed. In parallel, we work on the budget. And so I do work on the Appropriations Committee. And in a lot of cases, when you're trying to get a bill passed, there's also a request for money. And so the things sort of move in tandem quite often, and you really need both parts. Because a lot of times you pass a bill, but if there's a fiscal impact, as we call it, if there's a money need, if you don't get the money to go along with it, there's not much that's going to happen with the bill. So for example, with the voting access issue, there may be a relatively minor fiscal impact to make changes in the system to accommodate that. We want to make sure we get the budget dollars to go with it, because you need both parts. And that's where the Appropriations Committee comes in. And in a lot of cases where you have a really compelling bill like yours would be, it makes sense. But you need to line up your supporters at all levels, at the for the bill committee as well as for appropriations. In some cases, people wear both hats, and you can talk to one representative to cover you, but it's an important aspect to that. I think I've talked for a while here. I'd love to take some of your questions. Really enjoy being with you this morning. And again, you're just a great group, and we look forward to working with you.
Thank you.
Bringing you the microphone.
Oh, thank you.
Super. Good morning. My name is Doug Powell. I'm president of the ACB of Virginia. And we were behind that voting bill 100%. And I heard about the hearing after the hearing happened. So I wanted to ask you to speak a little bit about how we keep up with where the bills are, you know, what are the responsibilities between the constituents bringing the bill and the delegates sort of shepherding the bill, if I can use that word. So if you could speak a little bit more to the interaction that we have and you know how those can be more effective, I'd really appreciate it.
Yeah, I can certainly start, and I think Patrick can add to that. You know, we do have all the actions, all the meetings, all the bills, everything we do is tracked, and step back a little bit, is tracked online. So certainly through the, it's called the Legislative Information System, LIS, you can see all of that. But honestly, the best way to do is when there is a bill, and we'll have a bill again, work with your with the bill sponsor. Their staffs will definitely keep you apprised of committee meetings. Things change. I mean, it's not in terms of when things get scheduled, bills to be heard. And you may not always know a week in advance, oh yes, my bill is going to be heard in the subcommittee on a Thursday at 8 a.m. The staffs know that, though. And I think a constant communication, phone, email, text, whatever, will let you know, yeah, the bill's coming up, so you can get people to Richmond or online, because as Patrick said, we get a lot of testimony these days via Zoom, and that's totally appropriate and absolutely an option.
Yeah, we didn't know about the Zoom possibility. That'd be a heck of a lot easier.
And the only thing I'd add, I mean, just to underscore, it's really important you stay in contact with the patron's office about your interest in the bill and testifying for the bill. And then what we do is we coordinate. And I did that with another group that helped me bring the bill, but I don't know if they got their schedules misaligned or anything like that. So we'll bring the bill back. And let's make sure that we keep that lines of communication open so that we can make sure that we have a good contingency there and support.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Could I have the mic for a minute? Thank you. Okay, we will take Q&As, and I do want to thank Delegate Hope and Delegate Willett, and I really, really appreciate it. This was a wonderful, wonderful presentation from both of you. But let's have some questions. If you want to raise your hand, somebody will bring you a mic.
You have to use this mic. Are you a man?
Okay. Hello, April Allen. I'm in the Richmond area, and one of my questions is, one of the things you were really, it seems like you're talking about with the different laws and things is loopholes, how when you have a really good law and you think it's work, but it's always something about it once it's put in practice that you find, it's not, you know, working, and that can be a problem with getting changes done. So I'm wondering, like with the voting situation, because I remember I was one of those people when I was in college when they first came out with the machines that were all electronic, and they even had voice on them. But the thing about it was everything was awesome. It was cool. They actually got the machines in the voting districts very quickly. But then the problem I ran into and others was we got there and nobody knew, nobody was trained on them on how to work it, even how to turn the accessibility feature on. So it's like that's a loophole. Like that's something that everything that should be in place is in place, but we missed something. So that's what I'm saying. Like, is there, you know, how would you go about to making that sort of thing? Like, hey, we actually got what we need. We just need somebody to help us get through, you know, see where the training needs to be done with the poll mm-hmm. people and all that.
Yeah, no, that is a very good point. I've been doing this for 16 years. I've not read the perfect bill, but there always is the write it in the code, but you also need to make sure that it gets implemented properly. And voting is one of those things that has been for decades, generations, been one of those things that's been mostly left up to the states, but also left up to the localities.
Right.
And so just because you have the right does not always mean that you have the access. And so we need to make absolutely certain that when we do pass a law, particularly on voting, which is a part of our fundamental constitutional rights, we make sure that everyone can equally access voting. And that's why I feel so strongly about that bill, because it is a constitutional right. It's a fundamental right that you have access to the ballot box just like everybody else. So when we do pass a law to make things better, we need to make sure that we have the enforcement, not just in Richmond, not just in Arlington, but throughout the entire state. So it's really critical we follow through on making that law work for everybody. And we make these changes, we'll make sure that happens.
Our next question.
All right, so a quick one on regards to what you were just talking about, the voting one. We're always hearing on TV when the president or somebody's talking about they want to make changes to voting, they act like they want to make changes nationally, but if I understand correctly, voting is a state thing that the federal government really can't make changes. Is this true, or are we in danger of having them come over and make changes to the laws in Virginia? My other question is, when you're trying to put a bill together, I know that it takes a long time. What time of year or how long have some of these bills taken to go through that you discussed with us today? And like, what time would be a good time for us to start getting together with our representatives? And also, if we do put together a bill, how do we know where to go to help get it written appropriately?
All right, well, let me start with the first question, your last question is, the answer is now, right away, just like, let's do that. Our session starts at the second week in January, so start meeting with folks now. But Rod may want to add a little bit more on that. I'll say on the voting issue, absolutely right. Voting rights is traditionally a state obligation, but you also have to make sure you know who's in charge of your state. Like, who knows, you know that the executive branch always implements the laws of the state. And sometimes you have someone in the executive branch who's not as eager to implement all those state laws, or doesn't do them, remember, as I said, equally as accessible as well. Like, you can say there has to be early voting, or you have to say there has to be drop boxes. You don't say how many drop boxes there have to be. You have to have voting at a particular site, but maybe you only have one booth that you can vote in. And certain parts of the state could have multiple booths. That leads to long lines. If you have a really high populated, and this is historic, a high populated concentrated area of African Americans, we've seen people do some shenanigans where they only have one voting booth available. Mm-hmm. They say that's accessible, they say there's a voting site in your neighborhood, but when there's only one available, and then you go to other areas where they have multiple working voting booths, that's how you can get around the voting rights laws, and we cannot allow that to happen. So we have an election coming up. It's really important we make sure that people are exercising their rights at the state level to vote, and we have the right people. I'm not going to tell you who to vote for, but you have the right people that are implementing those laws and making voting accessible. And for me, that's what this electronic balloting is about, is making voting as easy as possible. Rod, do you want to add something?
No, I was come back to the second part of the question on terms of the bill drafting process. Patrick's absolutely right. Now is the time. As they always say, don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. A lot of times someone says, oh, I've got to get this bill draft in terms of being an advocate to us in this perfect form. No. Sometimes we just get ideas. I mean, literally just a concept, and then we have professionals who can take that idea and turn it into the correct legislative language. I mean, honestly, Patrick's been doing this longer than I have. I couldn't begin to think I could actually draft all the the legalese, even though I'm a lawyer, to fit the code. So that's why we have a professional staff to do that. But get those ideas in front of your representatives as soon as you can. Yes, it can be a multi-year process. Some bills are more complex. It takes longer to build consensus, and building consensus is important, so sometimes it's worth that extra effort. And the other case is going back to the point about a loophole, maybe it's just a sentence that needs to be changed, and that's not going to be the biggest lift in the world. And yeah, get that in front of us, we get that in the queue, and hopefully it goes through in a pretty fast fashion.
Okay, hi, I'm Sue Bowmaster. Thank you for being here. I have two quick questions. First of all, what do you recommend is the most direct way to find out who your delegate and senators are, other than going on the General Assembly website? Because my second question is related. What is the first step, or who should we approach to get the General Assembly website accessible? I found it very difficult to deal with.
Wow. Well, I really appreciate both of those questions. So what I use most frequently when someone says, who's my legislator, where do I vote, that sort of thing, VPAP, the Virginia Public Access Project, VPAP. Literally, you type in your street address and the whole thing is right there. That's a nonprofit that has done this for more than 25 years. All the financial disclosure information, who lobbies what, and then certainly who's vote or where you vote, all of that's right in there, and you can link right to it. Accessibility. I can't believe that we're still talking about website accessibility in 2025. When I was a practicing lawyer in the 90s, I worked on website accessibility issues. 1996, I think, is when I first worked on that issue. And that was pretty early in the internet, in terms of the internet evolution. And so, yes, we knew it was new technology. We were fighting the battles. But I did work quite a bit on that, actually, as a lawyer back in the day. And laws were passed, regulations were passed to make, in this case, particularly government websites accessible. So I am concerned, because I haven't looked at this issue for a long time, but we call it the Legislative Information System, LIS. But that's the General Assembly website. So in terms of the legislative information, and if you're having difficulty accessing that, that is most definitely a concern of mine. And I will definitely flag that. We certainly work with the people who take care of those websites. But and they did do a complete revamp of that this past year. So there is a new LIS. Hopefully that's more compatible, but I will definitely look into that.
Right. I think that's the charge under the ADA. And of course, Virginia led the country with the Virginia Disabilities Act. We were the first, and that became the model for the national. And so in the place where you're the first, we should make sure that we have everything accessible. I know that there's a big effort at the state agency level to make sure that their websites are accessible. But this is good feedback. Rod and I can talk to the clerk of the House and make sure that they're putting that effort into making sure that that's accessible as well.
Great question.
Okay.
Thank you for bringing that up.
Right there.
And by the way, this is how it's supposed to work, is that you bring issues to us, yeah, and we can help address them. This is exactly the way it's supposed to be.
Hi, this is Sam from Arlington. First of all, the ADA Title II regulations are coming up in April, so you better make that website accessible. And my question is, I got in contact with my local CVS, and I asked to sign up for Spoken Rx, which is a feature that CVS offers to allow you to use your phone to scan the prescription bottle and it will read the entire label to you. And my CVS told me that they don't offer it at their pharmacy and that I needed to go to another CVS. So my question is every pharmacy required to provide talking prescription labels, and what should we do if a pharmacy tells us that they can't provide them and we should go somewhere else?
So Sam, good question. Thank you for asking that. What we did is we had in the language that allows for other accommodations if possible. In other words, there might be some arrangement that they have with you to make sure that they can, maybe it's different size pill bottles, but they must make some sort of accommodation if they can't meet the requirements of the e-labeling requirement. And if they're not meeting that, then of course they're violating the law, and then we should have a conversation. So you should contact my office, and I can find out from the, I guess it's the, there's a division of pharmacists, must be a board of pharmacy, that came up with those regulations. And so that's something that we can bring to their attention. CVS is a large enough pharmacy that they should have this in every location. And so that's also something we could reach out to CVS about to make sure that they're complying with the law. Yeah. So let's do that. And I think that because we didn't get everything we wanted with that law, because I would have liked it to be a mandate, but that little mitigated language that said that they could make other accommodations that are similar seemed to be, might be something that is not as effective as we want. But I think there's a recognition, this is the nice thing, is the pharmacist said, we know that this is coming in the future, and we're willing to work with you to tighten up the language. So maybe in the next year, maybe next session, maybe the session after that, we can really make that a bold mandate for every pharmacy.
Okay, I wanted to make a couple of points if I could. What I'm hearing, I'm the chair of the Advocacy Committee. And by the way, I am looking to recruit members. So if you are interested in these kinds of topics, please see me. So I'm hearing several initiatives already being raised and things we can work on together with our delegates in the General Assembly. So the voting bill, Mr. Hope, we're with you. We're there, and we'll work with you on that one. You know, in terms of the prescription labeling, obviously that's important to a lot of us, so we can pursue that as well. And of course, the accessibility of your website. I think would be helpful to be able to give some examples of areas of the website that are not accessible, so we can gather some information that we can share that might be more helpful to somebody to pursue a solution. Are there other burning issues in this room, things that are frustrating to you that you're wondering how we could pursue on the state level? Anybody?
When I voted this last time, I made sure to let them know that I was going to be using the accessible machine. And so when I showed up and I told them, oh yeah, we've got to get somebody over here that knows how to use it, and they did come over. And when I started to use it, she stood behind me the whole time. And I finally said, you know, I'd kind of like to do this myself. But do you know, I had to call her over at the end, because in the machine they said, okay, now press the such and such button. And I was like, where's this button? So I had to call him over at the end anyways to push the button. So, you know, and I understand that each individual town and city order their own machines that the city or town pay for. And so the accessible machines are not equal in each town or city. Yeah. So, I mean, one town might have a very good accessible machine, and another one does not. And the people that make these machines, they think it's accessible, and they're not accessible. So, you know, I think it would be good if for all accessible machines to find the best accessible machine and have that mandated for every town and city.
Yeah, you said it better than I could. You're exactly right. And you know, it's like if you write a law and it's implemented unequal across the board, that's a problem. And that's something why we need someone at the top, at the executive level, who runs our elections, the Board of Elections. It's an executive branch agency, to make sure that we are making sure that everyone has equal access to the ballot box. Because you're exactly right.
And that's one of the reasons why I feel so strongly about the electronic voting, is you shouldn't have to rely on someone else standing over your shoulder watching how you vote. There should be a private time.
She wanted to make sure I was doing it right, but I wanted privacy.
That's right, and you deserve it.
Towards the end, I had to call her.
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly right. So you raised a very good point. You said it better than I could, and that is a problem. We need to solve it.
There is a help in the machine that I use at the polling place. There is a help area, and it explains where the buttons are and what they do. And one of them blacks out the screen. And the other one, you know, and another one, you know, does the printout. So it helps us if we educate ourselves. Take a few minutes to educate ourselves on how the machine is set up so that we can use it effectively. That puts us in a stronger position to, you know, to advocate for what we need. What I want is the accessible machines print out a ballot that's different in size from everybody else's ballot. So you can still identify who the disabled people were and who the regular people were. So I would love to find out why the printer for the ballots is a different size and needs to take a different piece of paper. Sorry.
It is different
and it differentiates us, and that's not right. Sorry if I misspoke myself.
My response to that is maybe you've identified another area we could work on in the law. And so that's something that we should take to the legislative committee to find out whether that's something we should work on. Because if that's a flaw in the statute, then that's something that maybe we could take a look at correcting. Unless there's reasons that I'm not aware of, maybe that's through regulation and not through statute, but we should look into that.
My name is Michonne Harrison, and I'm a veteran. So I have two questions, and I have one that we haven't touched upon, and that is transportation. First of all, for Fredericksburg, living in this area, we do have the Fred bus, but the Fred bus only caters to certain areas. So if you're like in my neighborhood in Leland, I have to walk 3 miles down a with no sidewalks to get to the place where they can pick you up at the Valero. They won't alter the route. And I have been here since 2014, and we can't get that fixed. The second thing is, about a month ago, we get a letter from the VA telling us that if we're not wheelchair bound, we're not using a walker or scooter, they're no longer providing transportation for us to get to the VA. We have to use Uber, $150 each way. What they're asking us to do is pay up front and then getting reimbursed. Knowing that all of us on we're fixed incomes, we can't do that. And anybody who's not fixed income, if you're having chemo or something where you have to go 3 days a week or something like that, you can't afford it. And they gave us less than a month notice. And then even the local healthcare center that they put here, we can't even get to that either. And I'm a veteran, so that's one of our issues. But this affects us all with the transportation, especially in rural areas like this. And in our local, the main hospital is 100 miles away.
Wow, that is so disappointing to hear that change. I can make a more general statement on transportation for medical services. That's something I've been looking at, numbers have been looking at. We actually even got some money in the budget this year to deal with the pilot program to get folks to the free clinic system who lack transportation. There's so much medical care that people are not getting right now because they can't get to the care. And that's a real impediment. We had something called the Select Committee on Rural Healthcare. I chaired that. We went around the state looking at rural areas, and uniformly, literally in dozens of meetings, we heard from all the providers, health systems, patient advocates, the whole gamut. And transportation was really one of the most significant things, barriers, the access to that where people are facing. Because your issues may be more specific to the VA, you may want to take that up with, we know we keep saying Congress doesn't do anything, but constituent services they're still doing. And I would definitely reach out to your congressman. You said you're here?
Yes,
said Vindman? Vindman, I think. Yeah, I think it'd be Congressman Vindman. You should reach out to his office. Okay, well, as you've heard a couple times, persistence, and sometimes it takes a voice and certainly join your friends. I mean, what you're describing is absolutely egregious. You should not have to go through that. The state side of it with, again, accessing the free clinics, there is a Medicaid transportation system, but that doesn't help everyone. So we're trying to fill those gaps, but it is a major concern.
Yes, thank you. Okay, transportation is definitely, Michonne, one of the things we need to work on. So, and we can work with you and with the Blinded Veterans Group as well. I mean, I think there's always more power as we work with our allies. So let's talk. Let's definitely talk about that. And there's rural transportation issues all over the state because Virginia has large areas that are rural. So, we want to make sure people have access in the city. I know where I am in Northern Virginia, transportation's pretty good. We have transportation, we have paratransit. We still have to fight for, the highest quality paratransit, but, we've got stuff going on. Yes.
One more question.
Yes.
All right, thanks. Pat Sheen, I'm from Maryland, but I'm dealing in the transportation area with WMATA and paratransit. But back to the lady, the veteran, I was going to also say Blinded Veterans Association would be great to talk to. Wade Davis is the new president over there, and I know that they're working on transportation issues. They are the veteran service organization that deals directly with Congress. So if you want to get someone's attention, talk to those folks over there. And they're right in right in Alexandria, I believe, and very effective group. So I
for that, sir, we cut up staff on the block.
Yeah.
What's that? Oh, okay, good.
But sometimes they're uneffective, so that's why I bring it up to
us. Great, beautiful. Thanks.
Find out what we've done.
Thank you
for
the kudos. That's good. That's good. Well, you guys are great. Very good. Excellent.
Let's see. Paul D'Addario and Marie and several of us met with VDOT a long time ago and got a lot about audio audible pedestrian signals, accessible pedestrian signals. So we got a change.
Oops. Oh, are we okay?
So a while ago we got a change so that every time an intersection is created or renovated, we can, they will put in where the traffic engineers have said they need a visual pedestrian signal, they also need to put in an audible one. So, and they also gave us 20 intersections a year that they would go ahead and retrofit, even if those intersections are not up for renovation in general. So we have that in place, but that's only if there's a visual signal there already. So I want to know from you guys, how many people in the rural part, more rural parts of the state, have to cross intersections where there's no signalization? So if you have those situations where you're getting to work or going to stores or whatever, please clap.
We'll try.
Okay, so there are some of us who live in those situations. I would like to see us advocate for more signalization on roads that are out in the out in the rural areas, so that people can safely walk and cross. And I know we can't put sidewalks everywhere, but we certainly would like to have more than we do now, right?
So that's another area where we could work on our advocacy efforts and find the best ways to start chopping away at that big thing with some smaller stuff.
Okay, thank you, Doug. I appreciate that, and we certainly will take up the issue of audible pedestrian signals. I did want to mention a couple quick things. How many of you, by show of hands, how many of you get Claire Stanley's announcements from the American Council of the Blind, the advocacy announcements that she issues?
I would tell you there's about 20 people at least.
About 20. All right. We need for everybody to subscribe to that list, the announced list of American Council of the Blind, and you know, because she provides excellent information. They have a platform that is called Speak For, and if you haven't used it, it's an easy platform. When they have an initiative, a bill they want you to weigh in on, and they'll ask you to contact your congressman. Now, this is at the federal level, okay? They have a link in their message. They explain the bill. You click on the link. It directs your message to your representative or your senator. And you can put their names in there. You can also add a paragraph so that it is personal to you. It is personal. You can tell your personal story. So you can add text in the message. And then you hit, and it has your name, your email, and your phone at the bottom, and you send it. And right before I came to the convention, I was going crazy with a lot of stuff. There was this whole thing now about how, of course, the Department of Education, you know, the staff was fired, then they may be reinstated. I don't know yet, but since they were fired, and this message came out, you know, tell your congressman this is a terrible thing. It's going to affect our services and programs. I did it. It took me maybe 10 minutes to write to my representative and my two senators. All I'm trying to say is it's easy. And if we can use that system here in Virginia, it will cost us $75 for whatever initiative that we want. This is a real easy thing to do. And the other thing I just want to say is for the committee hearings here at the state level, I believe you heard Mr. Hope say, you know, there's a lot of Zoom calls. Some of these hearings are on Zoom. They're virtual. So even if you live far away, you can still participate. And I guess what I most want you to leave here with is you have power, and let's use that power. And one of the things I would say too, if you are not a member of ACBVA, dues are only $13 if you join by the end of October. Okay, and if they may go up to $15 if we adopt our bylaws, which I hope we will. But please join us. I've heard some wonderful, very insightful comments from folks, you know, who are not our members, and I would love for you to join us. I'm also the chair of the membership committee, so I want to see that membership grow. So first of all, join me in giving a big round of applause to Delegate Hope.